and welcome to The Wire, independent current affairs on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Sarah Martin in Adelaide. Today on The Wire,
we as a compassionate and caring society need to realise that it's not just people with terminal cancer that suffer shocking.
Euthanasia campaigners welcome Victoria's Senate decision, and
I think we should be concerned because I think the cases that we've seen have been probably the tip of the iceberg.
Silicosis leaving construction workers short of breath. Also on the show, details from Australia's foreign policy white paper and a 99-year land deal, 10 years in the making. Stay tuned for these stories and more coming up on The Wire. Refugees at the Manus Island Detention Centre are reported to have been forcibly moved out today by Papua New Guinean authorities. Men at the centre took to social media this morning saying their belongings were being damaged and confiscated. Jana Favero, Director of Advocacy and Campaigns at the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre, was in Manus Island last week.
The verdict is in. Australia's foreign policy will so emphasising defence as a pillar of our foreign affairs.
What we saw when we visited the detention camp was really shocking and disturbing. And it was very obvious the deteriorating mental health and physical health of the men in the camp. I could easily see that people were very, very sick. Men who had superficial burns, but there was no treatment there, so could easily become infected. And there's no running water, so the men are digging wells to be able to get access to water, which is obviously unhygienic, full of bacteria. They're getting stomach issues, burns on their body, lumps on their body, rashes on their body from the water. And you also have men who were on medication for things like epilepsy, for diabetes, for heart conditions, and that medication has all stopped. So there are people with really preventable serious medical conditions who are not on any medication anymore and are in grave danger. I walked away with a sense that someone is about to die and we're responsible for that.
What do you know of what's going on there?
We didn't get an indication there was much appetite for PNG officials to be moving the men from the camp, so it was a real surprise when I woke up this morning to that news, just getting messages from the men in the camp saying, help me, help me, help me, please. It was just so distressing. The men are reporting that there are up to 50 PNG police who are coming into the camp who are destroying their property. There are reports of two men who we saw last week who were seriously ill who are now, or who were in an unconscious state. Unfortunately, there's no official way into the camp, so no one can be showing the real truth apart from what the men are releasing themselves in very precarious, heightened situations. But it has definitely escalated and I have real deep concern for the safety of the men in there.
When you get those calls from the refugees saying, help me, what steps do you take?
Well, the first thing I do is I link them to our detention advocacy program. We have a full-time staff member who focuses on helping people, men, women and children, in detention onshore and offshore. Two men who were where help was being asked for them. We already knew who they were. We knew their medical conditions. We got a doctor on the phone immediately who gave us information that we then passed on. We tried to link them directly to the men surrounding those who are ill, but phone reception is really difficult at the moment. Of course, we are limited in what we can do, but because we do have a detention advocacy program at ASRC that directly gives as much support as we can to the men, that's first and foremost.
We've got a lot of prominent people saying, let us in, let us help. Mm-hmm. What do you want to see the government do there?
The only safe thing for the men on Manus is for them to be evacuated immediately. In the meantime, if the government's saying that's too hard, it's going to take too long, which I don't think it is, they must also have access to medical facilities, especially those who are sick. So we do echo those calls of the AMA and also of the, you know, 12 former Australians of the Year. I mean, it's just kind of ironic that on the day 12 prominent Australian leaders who have been recognised by the Australian community and government as people who we look up to as our role models are calling for urgent evacuation and medical treatment for the men on Manus. And then on the other hand, our government was coming out today, again, sort of bad-mouthing refugees, which is quite a stark difference in leadership and compassion. And I do think that history will judge us harshly on how we as a country are treating people in offshore detention.
Jana Favero, Director of Advocacy and Campaigns at the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre. Next up, I've got Rebecca here from the newsroom. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, Sarah.
The Bosnian war crime Ratko Mladic trial has finally ended after first starting in 2011.
That's right. Ratko Mladic was sentenced to life in prison for his role in the Bosnian-Serbian war after 16 years in hiding, before his arrest in 2011.
We, as a compassionate and caring society...
The crimes committed rank among the most heinous known to humankind and include genocide and extermination as a crime against humanity. The chamber sentences Mr. Ratko Mladic to life imprisonment.
What were his crimes during the Bosnian-Serbian war?
From 1992 to 1995, the tribunal found that Mr. Mladic was the chief military organizer of the campaign to drive Muslims, Croatians and other non-Serbians off of land. In Sarajevo, the Bosnian capital, snipers and shelling threatened residents for more than 3 years, and 8,000 Muslim men and boys were executed in Srebrenica.
South Australia is now home to the world's largest battery, and it only took 70 of the 100-day goal.
That's right. Tesla has completed construction of the giant lithium-ion battery, and it's set to begin testing in early December. The battery has been described as the world's largest.
There was really this opportunity to make a significant statement about renewable energy to the world, to show that you can really do a heavy-duty, large-scale utility-level battery system, and that South Australia was up for the challenge.
And how will the battery be used in South Australia?
The battery will be used to help stabilise South Australia's power grid and could help stop thousands of households losing power, as the state government will be able to tap into the battery's entire power output when the state is running low on power and load shedding is imminent.
Thanks, Rebecca. Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull today unveiled a historic white paper on foreign policy, the first of its kind in the past 14 years. The report aims to provide Australia with a long-term outlook of what our international relations will look like. So what will the future bring for this uncertain world? Benito Carboni has the story.
The verdict is in. Australia's foreign policy will retain its focus of promoting open trade and global diplomacy, whilst also emphasising defence as a pillar of our foreign affairs. The rules-based system that Turnbull wants would see globalist ideals like free trade agreements thrive, with or without the help of the United States. The report also acknowledges China as a world power on the level of the US, stressing their relationship as vital. I spoke to Dean Forbes, Emeritus Professor at Flinders University, to get a better appreciation of the paper.
What's particularly important about the timing is that there have been some major shifts that have occurred across our region, and those shifts get caught up in this paper, I think, very clearly.
What is the international rules-based system that Malcolm Turnbull keeps pushing?
It's basically that whole infrastructure of international agencies that provide a sort of stable and manageable set of rules that enable trade and exchanges and transport routes to operate, all those sorts of things that we need to be able to move across the globe.
Many were surprised to see the absence of foreign aid as a main tenet of the report, with numerous charities expressing their dismay at the government's attitude towards an already dwindling resource. Here is Dean Forbes again.
I think the government would see that we're in a particularly vulnerable time where things are happening which we can't really manage. For instance, we know that China is now much more powerful and much stronger and outward-looking and doing things that are going to have a big influence on us. We know that North Korea is behaving erratically and putting the world at risk. And we know that the United States, with a president that's somewhat unfocused and all over the place, is no longer quite as reliable and transparent as it had been. So that this is a time when we actually do need much more focus on international affairs. There is a concern about aid. It doesn't come through in a strong way. There is recognition that the Pacific Islands is one of the regions where we do need to really continue to focus on providing support.
One of the statements that came from it was, the Australian government judges that the United States' long-term interests will anchor its economic and security engagement in the Indo-Pacific. Does this point to the government attempting to navigate safely through this protectionist Trump era until a more globalist thinking president is elected?
I think it certainly is a reaction to the US, but I think also a reaction to China. I think the whole idea of talking about an Indo-Pacific region instead of an Asia-Pacific region, which was pretty much the standard language of the past, reflects the government's belief that India, with its giant population, will be a much more important player within our overall region, will help to somewhat offset the influence of China, and Australia will be in a position to engage in that Indo side of the Indo-Pacific region and take advantage of what is happening.
Australia sees itself as a crucial player in relations between the United States and China. How do you think we will see that evolve over the next decade?
Oh, I think it's a very complicated and difficult role to play. There's even a lot of diversity in views within Australia about how Australia connects with China and whether we're getting a good deal or not, how we deal with China and how we, because there's sort of such difficult issues as the risks in the South China Sea and China's Belt and Road Initiative, which is driving very much westward. I think this is a very complex time. I think it's going to be very hard for Australia to see its way through it.
Dean Forbes, Emeritus Professor at Flinders University, ending the story by the wise Benito Carboni. The Gumatj clan have established Gunyangara Township in northeast Arnhem Land over many years, and a decade of negotiations with the government. This past weekend, they signed a 99-year lease, giving traditional owners control of their land. Klaus Helms is the CEO of Gumatj Corporation. The wise Jessica Supple asked him about the work the clan has done in the community.
So, you know, we started off building a school and a kitchen and we built a community shop, and then we built workshops and started in the timber harvesting and timber mills and cattle stations, and we bought an abattoir. Then we got into a cement works and bought a batch plant, and then we got a brick works. And then we developed further out, and now we've got a regional training centre where we train the people. And now we're starting on our bauxite mine.
So what will that new 99-year lease mean for the community?
I guess, look, for an onset, what it does mean is that they won the first 99-year lease that is up this end of the world, meaning security of land tenure. So everyone says the traditional owners, they own the land, but there's no tenure. It's really hard to get a bank loan or to get any equity involved in it if you don't have a lease. The thing is with this, it's 99-year lease. Very, very long term. Most leases up here you get for 12 years, not 99. Banks don't loan for 12 years. The second part is it allows us to build housing for our Indigenous workers. It allows us to then start to get the community to think about owning their own houses and their own leases to buy and sell and build up the economic value of the whole area here.
So what does it mean for traditional owners to be in control of their own land?
Well, they're pretty happy about it. Also happy about the fact that it's such a long-term agreement. You know, it really gives them pride in owning a place, pride that they can now say it really is theirs. It's not just a token of word. It's on paper. It's tenure. It means a lot to them.
Am I correct in saying that this is the first type of this particular lease, isn't it, where the community holds the lease rather than a separate Commonwealth officer?
That's correct. And also, it's not held by the Northern Land Council or Commonwealth Officer, both Federal and Northern Territory. It's run by the community itself.
This has taken around 10 years to be agreed to. What were some of the issues that you found with the original proposal?
Well, there was quite a number of issues. One, the concept had to be got through. A lot of legal arguments had to be got through. There was also the understanding by the traditional owners and then convincing the Northern Land Council and the Northern Territory Government and the Federal Government. But eventually we got it through. And also a lot of understanding, a lot of negotiations with the traditional owners themselves, that they all understood what we were getting into. But, yeah, they're They've come through a very long journey to get this. But on the way, they've understood economic development, and that's what really got us over the line.
So is this something you would like to see more of in the Indigenous communities in the top end?
Yeah, look, providing that the community and the boards and the clans are strong enough to be able to run and manage. It's not just getting the lease. It's being able to know where the funds will come from to, and the leasing and the understanding that, you know, it all comes onto their authority. It's not that easy to do, but I believe it can be done. It needs the community to work as a whole to get it, though.
Klaus Helm, CEO of the Gumatj Corporation, speaking with The Wire's Jessica Supple.
After a hard day out in the paddock, I like to catch up with The Wire. Find out what's going on around this big country.
The Wire, bringing you the stories from all around Australia.
After a 24-hour sitting of the Victorian Upper House, voluntary-assisted dying legislation looks set to become a reality, with the Legislative Council passing the bill 22-18. The Wire's Rachel McDonald has the report.
Elizabeth Short's husband Peter died at the end of 2017 from esophageal cancer and spent the last months of his life campaigning for the changes proposed in the Victorian bill.
He was given 3 to 9 months approximately to live. His lungs were going to slowly deteriorate and he would have to be on oxygen, and then he would, as one doctor described it, die of slow suffocation.
Shortly after diagnosis, Peter read about Dr. Rodney Syme, who had given the euthanasia drug Nembutal to a terminally ill patient.
So he contacted Dr. Syme and they had discussions, and Peter became very interested in the concept of dying with dignity. Rodney supplied him with the drug Nembutal, which in itself is an illegal act, but Rodney was virtually saying, I am handing out this drug to people who I have consulted with, who I know are terminal, who I know are facing intolerable suffering, both mentally and physically, and if you want to come and arrest me, come and do it. And he, as he put it, sort of came up over the trenches to say the way we're operating now is wrong and the lawmakers have to change things.
In the end, Peter's plans for his end of life changed as his health deteriorated further.
On Boxing Day morning 2014, he was very unwell. We couldn't control his symptoms at home, and he agreed to enter palliative care just long enough to sort of get him comfortable again and stable again and get his meds sorted, and then we agreed that he would come home and then he would take his own life because he'd always wanted to die at home. When we got to palliative care and he did get settled and they did make him comfortable, we were only there probably for an hour, and he said to me, I've changed my mind, I think I'll stay. That was the 26th of December, and Peter died on the 29th of December. But the very important thing, I think, to remember in this whole, or in Peter's story particularly, was he didn't choose to take the Nembutal, but the fact that he had the choice was the thing that made the difference to his life.
Elizabeth is pleased about the Victorian legislation passing through the Upper House, despite its conservative approach.
It's a very, very rigid set of circumstances, and they've taken the qualification of 12 months left to live down to 6 months, which I personally think is ludicrous, because no doctor would stand up and say you'll be dead 6 months from now with a cancer diagnosis, because they just don't know. They speak from statistics, but it's only a best guess. They have to have been residents of Victoria for at least 12 months. There's quite a few hoops they have to go through. They have to make the request. You know, I think it has to be made again in front of two doctors and a psychiatrist. It has to be put in writing, and then 10 days later it has to be made again, and then they will be delivered the medication.
Elizabeth says the legislation could have gone further.
We, as a compassionate and caring society, need to realise that it's not just people with terminal cancer that suffer shocking, lingering and unnecessary deaths. But it's a great first step.
Elizabeth Short, advocate for voluntary assisted dying. Dr. Rodney Syme is the Vice President for Dying with Dignity Victoria. I spoke to him about why he chose to help people like Peter Short and how he feels about the bill.
I've been thinking about this from an ethical and emotional point of view for 43 years and been a public advocate for this change for 25 years. So it was a particularly poignant moment for me when pass the upper house.
Why do you believe voluntary assisted dying is so necessary in Australia?
Because there's absolutely no logic to people who have got severe and intolerable suffering being forced to go on to end their lives in what might be euphemistically called a natural death if that is not what they want. For me as a doctor, if a person is in that circumstance and says, I can't stand this any longer, what can you do to help me? Since I respect their autonomy, I believe that they should have a right to make decisions about their own life and death, then I feel compelled to provide them with assistance if that's possible. What this bill will allow is for doctors to start to have those sort of discussions. In the past, doctors have been inhibited from talking openly about death and dying because they really were restricted in what they could potentially offer. Now they will be able to engage in discussion with their patients. Very often that's all that's necessary. Once a patient knows that they have got the right under the law to make a request, they are enormously assisted psychologically and existentially by that possibility.
What would you say to those who oppose the bill and are concerned vulnerable members of society could be threatened?
Well, I think that's absolute nonsense. The bill specifically states that it's imperative on the doctor to ensure that the patient is not under duress and ensure that the patient is of sound mind. Believe me, it's very, very easy to detect if somebody else is putting a person under pressure to take an action to end their life. There have been very, very serious surveys carried out in other countries, particularly very thoroughly in Canada, which found that this idea had no basis in fact whatsoever.
Rodney Syme, Vice President of Dying with Dignity Victoria, ending that report by The Wire's Rachel McDonald. Australia's peak body representing lung health professionals has today issued a warning to people working with dusts. Silicosis is a lung disease currently affecting Australia and in particular people that work in trades. Deborah Yates is a thoracic physician who specialises in occupational medicine and has worked with patients with many respiratory disorders, including silicosis. The Wire's Henry Wilson asked Deborah how silicosis affects people.
Silicosis makes people breathless, it makes them cough, and it has a way of becoming inexorably worse so that this continues until they become very short of breath and they either die or they need a transplant.
And how do people get it?
Only from inhaling silica dust. And silica dust is one of the commonest dusts around. Silica comprises a lot of the world's surface, and the people who are primarily affected are usually the people who work with dusts in occupations such as mining, tunnelling, sandblasting, construction work, concreting, pottery works, and those sort of trades.
And how concerned should Australia be about the potential silicosis disease?
We should be concerned. We have had a number of cases of silicosis occurring in New South Wales and in Victoria and elsewhere, with silicosis occurring in previously less recognised occupations. And the one that's been best documented is that with artificial stone products, which are the products that we all have in our kitchens and bathrooms, the beautiful sort of marble-type stone, which is not actually marble, but is made by reconstituting stone. And this has quite a high silica content. The workmen who come into your house to make your kitchen, bathrooms look beautiful, and also in a lot of modern hotels, then they produce the dust, which can be inhaled into the lungs and give you silicosis.
And how has the disease affected other countries?
They've had problems elsewhere as well. I mean, the main... They've had terrible trouble in Turkey, where they had an incident with large numbers of very young people, people in their age of about 19, actually dying of silicosis when silica was used for sandblasting jeans. And there have been cases really throughout the world, particularly and also in the USA, where they've had a resurgence of black lung, but quite a lot of those cases have actually had silica involved as well, because what they're doing is using new mining methods that are actually more effective in cutting through the stone and separating the coal dust from the other types of rock. And that means that they're cutting more into silicious rock than they ever did before. And if you look at the third world countries, some of them actually have extremely high rates of silicosis.
And are we taking the right steps to prevent silicosis from affecting Australia?
There are regulations already in use which are effective, but they're only effective if they're actually followed. And I think there's been a problem with lack of understanding and I suppose a sense of complacency from everybody, really. And I think the people who work in the larger mining companies know more about this, and therefore the standards are probably better than they are in the smaller employments where people don't know enough about it and the workforce doesn't even know of the importance of respiratory protection or the use of proper ventilation. Silicosis is just one of the many different types of occupational lung disorder that are actually around that we haven't diagnosed, and that, again, it's an example of the sort of occupational lung disease that's totally preventable, but there are many others.
Thoracic physician Deborah Raitt speaking to The Wire's Henry Wilson. That's it for The Wire today. We'll be back again tomorrow, so please tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of Radio Adelaide, and I'm Sarah Martin. Thanks for your company.
Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.